appreciate the presence of everyone this day. Good to have all of our visitors with us. Glad you're here. I want you to come back and see us every time you can. Host Waits, good to have you here. You need to be here more often. And Jenny would act better if you were here more often. We try to do the best we can, curtailing her activities. But it's glad to have you on site today. Good to see everyone here. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, Solomon made it clear that there are times for the various things in the program of God. We sometimes go back and read those first few verses. I'm not going to take the time to do it now, but each thing that God has arranged in the program of human existence has its place. There's a time for this and a time for that. And we have lived, of course, to experience that application of those principles even in our lives. That's the way that life is. And I think about the particular time in which we live today. I think about the way it was when I was growing up. I think about the way it was from hearing my father talk about the days of his youth and his childhood. And there's been such a change in things. I used to like to talk with him because, of course, my life was rooted in his life and my experiences were rooted in his experiences. And the way that I was shaped to be, a preacher and a teacher of the gospel, that all came from his experiences. And so I love to think about that and read books that put me in touch with his times. I don't know how many times I've read that biography of M.B. Hardeman, a bunch. But in restoration history, even back in the 1800s. And you try to see the way it was, the way people were thinking, the issues with which they were dealing, the obstacles that were perplexing them. And then you think about the way it is now. What kind of a time is it? And sometimes, in a moment, it may be that I'm evaluating the situation more subjectively and individually and personally, and maybe I get sort of caught up in my own little world. Instead of seeing myself in a broad time, the way things are out there, maybe something has happened in my life or to my family, and I'm thrown to more personal introspection, and I'm thinking just in terms of my experiences, not mine and yours and the church and the brotherhood and the nation, but maybe just mine. And so I'm thinking about, what a hard life this is, or what a terrible time, what a rotten month this has been, or just things of that sort. So my time may not be your time in that kind of a comparative sense. So I want us to think today about the way that the Bible uses language to discuss periods and moments in maybe a nation's life or maybe in a person's life. And you think about it and you live with it and you pray through it, and you're the better because you have looked at it the way that God wanted you to. The lesson is entitled, It May Be a Time. It May Be a Time. And I want you to turn to Psalm 37. A psalm that my father used to call the Fret Not Psalm. That's the way it begins. Fret not. And that comes up several times in this one psalm. It's also the psalm it talks about inheriting the earth in verse 11 and verse 22. But the first point is, it may be a time of pervasive wickedness. That's point number one in this lesson. A time of pervasive wickedness. I want us to start in verse 12. The wicked plotteth against the just and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. Now watch it. The Lord shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. The day of the wicked, God envisions that, his day of punishment, his day of calamity, his day of just rewards, it is approaching. It's in the mind of God. It's certainly not necessarily in the mind of the wicked, but it ought to be in the mind of the just, in the mind of the righteous. The Lord shall laugh at him, For he seeth that his day is coming. The wicked have drawn out the sword and have bent their bow to cast down the poor and needy. Does God care about the poor and needy? And to slay such as be of upright conversation or upright in the way. Does God care about those that are upright in their lives? Their sword shall enter into their own heart, and their bow shall be broken. A lot of times in Scripture, it's not that he's just predicting specific ways they're going to die, but he's using these descriptions to discuss their overthrow. They're going to finally get what they dispense. Justice will be done. A little that a righteous man has is better than the riches of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord upholdeth the righteous. The Lord knoweth the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. You see, you can't take my inheritance away from me. They shall not be ashamed in the evil time. Here it is. That is the righteous, the upright. Those who have this inheritance, they shall not be ashamed in the evil time. And in the days of famine they shall be satisfied. But the wicked shall perish, and the enemies of the Lord shall be as the fat of lambs. They shall consume, in the smoke shall they consume away. Now that's enough right there. But I'm simply saying that oftentimes the Lord uses the language that paints the pictures that connect with the images with which the people are familiar, in order to say, look, I know how it is on the earth. He knows how it is in the days of the psalmist, with Israel, under the law of Moses, and the pagans out there, the enemies of Israel. And he's simply saying that, I know what they're like and what they do to you and how you feel, and how it looks from the perspective of the upright and the godly on the earth. Their time is coming. So, if you're in an evil time, a time of pervasive wickedness and danger and great concern and great risk, be at ease. Fret not. Fret not. You don't have to worry about that. You can be concerned about it, and you ought to. Don't live like a fool. But don't worry about that. And so in the time when your nation seems to be morally self-destructing, situations around you seem calamitous, maybe the economy is falling, maybe you're at an age when your health is beginning to give way, you're losing people in your family. I've never lost a brother before, or a sister before, or a mother, daddy before, and it's happening, and it's okay, that's all right. God knows every moment, and He knows the epochs, the periods of time, and He knows how to properly describe the moment through which you're personally passing, and the moment through which the nation is passing, and the church is passing. Don't be overly concerned about the evil time. That is, don't think they're going to win. They're not going to win. And justice will be done, and I have my eye on my covenant people. The psalmist was a part of the covenant people of God. Well, that's me. That's me today. Jeremiah 31:31, Hebrews 8:8. I am a part of the covenant people of God. And so when we look around and we're staggered by the massive amount of immorality and corruption, and I tell you, brethren, the more you hear, I still take pride. Don't misunderstand me. I'm most grateful that I can be an American. I've been in a few places and had to travel through some to get to some others, I guess. And man, what a joy it is to come home. What a joy on this earth it is to come home. But I used to be more proud of my country and my government. And I've lost a lot of that because I try to evaluate things in the light of the way God is describing them. But we keep praying, you know. We don't lose heart. We just keep praying and concerning ourselves. But this is a day of monumental corruption and lie-telling and scandals and cover-ups and hypocrisy. Just to hear politicians answer questions sometimes. I mean, what I ought to say is to see them not answer questions while they speak It's incredible. You know, if you had some way of just holding, look, you didn't answer, you didn't answer, you didn't answer. I've had preachers do me that way. I remember one right now in a special case. I said, you didn't answer my question. Well, I'm not going to answer in your words. My words, phooey, you're not going to answer the question. And he never did. And that's the way politicians do. And yet they talk. And it's sometimes, it's painful. It's painful to watch them, you know, finagling around, trying to make the reporter lose track of the initial question while they just talk and make noise and try to leave the impression, you see there, I know how to deal with this. It's painful. The days through which we pass, very wicked. It may be a wicked time. In fact, right now it is. Is it not? Now, I want you to go over to Psalm 41 and verse 1. Psalm 41 and verse 1. You could describe this time like this. You could say, we're in trouble. This is a time of trouble. Oh, my. And that's why we so sincerely pray for our country. We pray with the intensity of feeling and concern because of what looks to be like inevitable calamity if we don't do something. Blessed is he that considereth the poor. The Lord will deliver him in time of trouble. When that time arrives, God says, I know how to distinguish between, and he's talking, of course, to Israel, my people who are concerned about their brother and their neighbor, and those who simply do not care. All of these features of character, these traits of character, to God, they've always mattered. Remember Matthew 22, 37 through 40, Jesus says that the whole law and the prophets, they can all be summed up in love for God and love for neighbor. So, did you concern yourself with that poor man, that poor woman in Israel? What about Ruth? You know, laboring out there in Boaz's field, trying to get some food. What about all that? Did you have any compassion for the poor and the needy? God says, when trouble comes, I know how to make distinctions between somebody who loves his neighbor and somebody who doesn't. Well, that's an interesting concept. Job 3, it comes up again in verse 26, when Job was all of a sudden hit with all of that misery and all of that devastating loss, and he sits back in that ash heap in pure misery and confusion. And he can't get a handle on it. What just happened here? And the text says, the King James Version has it in the past tense, yet trouble came. American Standard puts it in the present tense, yet trouble cometh. And more trouble he was to face by the aggravation of the misinterpretation of his friends. But I'm saying that the Bible makes it clear that God knows how to recognize these distinctions. Now I want you to go to Revelation chapter 3 and the letter to the church at Philadelphia. In Revelation 3 and verse 10. I do not understand this. I bring up this passage for your consideration, your further consideration. But notice what he says to this good church at Philadelphia. Let's start in verse 9. Behold, I give up the synagogue of Satan. Of them that say they're Jews, and they're not. They don't really know what a real Jew is now. But do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet. See, it's just like what we were reading about in the Psalm a while ago. Justice will be done. Situations will be reversed. You're going to be all right. And to know that I have loved thee. One of these days they're going to know that. Because thou didst keep the word of my patience, I also will keep thee from the hour of trial. That hour which is to come upon the whole world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Now, I don't think that's a reference to what they're going to face with Rome and the army of Rome and Caesar and all of that in the first century. It's a trial that's going to come on the whole world. It seems to me, but I just suggested, I'm not being conclusive here. You work on it as well. But it looks to me like the hour of trial right here is the hour of final judgment. And God is saying, I know the faithful church in Philadelphia. And I know what you people are like. And when the hour of trial comes upon the whole world, I'm going to keep you from it. That is, you're going to be okay. And it's as a congregation. It's not just looking at the individual, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, Mr. and Mrs. Black, or whatever. But he's looking at it from the viewpoint of the congregation because it's congregational fidelity. They're steadfast. They love God. They have stood up for the truth. And I'm going to show some people that hate you that I've always loved you. And I'm going to keep you from that hour. It looks to me in the context and the way that the wording is that they're safe, he's saying, as things stand, they're safe at judgment. God knows how to make distinctions. And just because you may live in a pervasively wicked and increasingly violent and volatile period, that's okay. You're not the first. And if the Lord lets the earth stand, you probably won't be the last. But it's me this time. It's me. And that gets my attention. You know, if it's you, that's something else. I can live with that. But when it's me, my, it gets awfully, awfully significant, doesn't it? Number three. It's a time, maybe a time of visitation. Maybe a time of visitation. In Isaiah 10 and verse 3, the period of visitation is a period of desolation. Look at verse 3, Isaiah 10 and verse 3. And what will ye do in the day of visitation? And in the desolation which shall come from far, to whom will ye flee for help? And where will ye leave your glory? Now in chapters 30 and 31, he will warn them about trying to get help from Egypt. How many allies does America have? I don't know. How many people consider us allies anymore? How many people are laughing at us, mocking us because of our administrations being out of touch with reality? But what about the day of visitation? Now right here, as you see, it's described as a day of desolation. Now you can think you're going to run to Egypt and you're going to have the Egyptian army and you're going to have their horses and somehow they're going to stave off Babylon. It's not going to work. It's not going to serve you well at all. In fact, he says, Egypt is just like a sharp spear. You're going to put your hand on it. It's like it's going to come through your hand, as it were. You're leaning on something that's going to hurt. When America stops leaning on God in a general sort of sense, in the respecting of moral law and biblical principles, and starts leaning on other things to make its way, it's leaning on things that can only pierce. When the church stops listening to the Scriptures, members of the church stop living their personal lives in the light of holy truth and practice. They're practicing pure religion. When you stop the practice of pure religion, you're leaning on a spear. It can only hurt. You can only suffer because of it. In Jeremiah 10, 15, verse 5, I'm sorry, 15, it is 15. Jeremiah 10, 15, the day of visitation is a day of perishing. Here in Isaiah, this passage, it was a day of desolation. Over there in Jeremiah 10, it's a day of perishing. Isaiah and Jeremiah are both prophesying with regarding to the coming of Babylon. And in Micah 7 and verse 4, the day of visitation is a day of perplexity. You know, we're not the only ones that try to evaluate the situation, see the way things are in the world, what's happening in the country, what's happening in Washington, because that affects me. And in Micah, it's a day of perplexity. When people raise questions because they're perhaps baffled. Well, how does this work. How does this happen? How did we get into this mess? What are we going to do now? A day of perplexity. Now, when you come to the New Testament, these aren't all the passages of visitation, but at least it's three. When you come to Luke 19:44, it seems to me, and I'm not going to be dogmatic about this, but it seems to me that when the day of visitation is referred to in Luke 19 and verse 44, he's talking about the day that the Jews did not recognize when it arrived. Now look at verse 41. And when he drew nigh, he saw the city, that is, Jesus saw Jerusalem and wept over it, saying, if thou hadst known in this day, even thou the things which belong unto peace, but now they're hid from thine eyes. For the day shall come upon thee when thine enemies shall cast up a bank about thee, and compass thee round, and keep thee in on every side, and shall dash thee to the ground, and thy children within thee, and they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation. He's saying, it seems to me, in this context, if you had only understood when John came and when I came, that was your visitation from God. The law and the prophets were until John. From that time, the gospel of the kingdom is preached, and men enter violently into it. Most of you Jews didn't recognize what had happened. Elijah was in fact here, and he said, I was coming, and I did. And you did not know that. Now look at you. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killeth the prophet and stoneth them that are sent unto her. How often would I have gathered thy children together as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. And ye shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. You're going to have a reversal of disposition, but right now you're facing desolation. Because you didn't know the hour of your visitation. And you turned God down. Well, you come over to 1 Peter 2 and verse 12, and Peter uses that. And here, it seems to be in each man's life. Look at verses 11 and 12, 1 Peter 2. Beloved, I beseech you as sojourners and pilgrims, we referred to this passage last Wednesday night, to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your behavior seemly or appropriate among the Gentiles, that wherein they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works which they behold glorify God in a day of visitation. There's no article there. In a day of visitation. That would seem, in the providence of God, whenever there is an opportunity for them to come to the knowledge of and obedience to the truth. Conduct your lives, he says, so that when these non-Christians look at you, when circumstances are right and conducive, maybe it's the optimal moment in their life. Maybe that's what it is. The optimal moment in their life. When a day of visitation, maybe they'll have several days of visitation. And maybe most of those days in their lives are prompted because of your good life. And when one of these days of visitation shows up, maybe they'll glorify God. Maybe on one of them, they'll finally glorify God. Instead of always criticizing those people that call themselves the church, those people claiming to be Christians only, those people that are opposed to false doctrine and wrong living, maybe on one day, when God makes a providential visit, maybe they'll glorify Him that day because you conducted yourselves like He told you to do. Interesting, isn't it? So it may be a day of visitation in somebody's life. Now go over to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. And it might be a grievous time. A grievous time. This is not greasy. It's not a greasy time, and it's not a grievous. There's no such word as grievous. Grievous. Grievous is the word. And notice this in 2 Timothy 3. Paul saying to the young preacher Timothy, but know this, that in the last days grievous times shall come. So maybe it's a grievous time as I'm looking at it and thinking about it. Maybe that's the way it is in my life or my community or my country or maybe the brotherhood. For men shall be lovers of self. Have you ever known anybody that loved himself more than anybody else? More than he loved God? See, you've got self-love or God-love. And God says you've got to love me first. And you've got to love your neighbor as yourself. You're supposed to love yourself. But this is a bad sense of it. This is an introversion of regard that is selfish and without perspective. I love myself. It's interesting, too, the way it's put by Paul in Ephesians 5. He doesn't say it this way, but he says, no man ever hated his own... But he doesn't say no man ever hated himself. Notice that distinction. He doesn't say that. But he did say, no man ever hated his own flesh. Curious, isn't it? No man ever hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it. Nobody in his right mind walks around with a hammer beating on his fingers. Nobody in his right mind stabs himself with spears. No, we're always trying to protect and cover and watch out for. No man ever hated his own flesh. And here this self-love, it's without balance. It's without proper direction. Lovers of self, they put themselves ahead of God, ahead of truth. Lovers of money, ever known anybody like that? I'm not talking about people with money. I'm talking about lovers of money. Their day, their night, their life. It's all about money. It's all about having things. It's about accumulation of things. It's getting more. And that's life. And Jesus had plainly said, a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things that he possesses. You can't have a clearer warning. And they that are minded to be rich fall into a temptation and a snare, and many foolish and hurtful lusts such as drown men in destruction and perdition. You can't have clearer warning. And yet most people, or at least a lot of people still, the mind is always on the money. It's always on the money. And so they'll abuse you and you and you and you to get more money. They'll cheat, they'll lie, they'll steal, they'll defraud, they'll do whatever is necessary to get more of the money. Boastful. Oh, if this isn't a day of boasting in our country, it's just out of control. Solomon warned us about, you know, blowing our own trumpet, as it were. Let another man, if you want something good said about you, let another man do it. It is not a show of wisdom to do it yourself. That indicates non-wisdom. And in our culture, you just do it. It's just natural. Because the society has become so displaced in thinking. Boastful, haughty, not humble, haughty, railers. They just talk down against a lot of things, regardless of whether they know the truth about it or not. Speaking in contemptible words about things. You know, that people do that, I think, partly to try to lift themselves up in the estimation of other people. To make other people think, I know a lot about this, and I'm telling you that this is dumb, and this is wrong, and this is wrong. Now, whether it is or not, some people, I think, do that in order for us to think they're smart. Instead of just looking and trying to evaluate things, it's to always come down against them so as to show that I'm in power and I'm in control and I can see and I'm telling you that's stupid and that's dumb and that's stupid and all of that. Contempt. Holding things in contempt. Railing. Disobedient to parents. Has there been a case or two of that lately in America? Disobedient to parents. What are parents for anymore? What are parents for? disobedient to parents, unthankful. Is there any ingratitude in the country for the way that God has blessed this country? Any gratitude for morality? Any gratitude for scriptural things, righteousness, dignity, worth, value, decency? Unholy? Has our nation, morally speaking, gone to the dogs? Without natural affection? Why do people abuse their spouses and their children? Without natural affection? Implacable? You know what that word means? Incapable of being appeased. Incapable of being pacified. Incapable of being mitigated. You ever known anybody like that? Regardless of what you do, you can't satisfy. That says the last days, these are the days of the church. You're going to see people like that. Regardless of what you say, regardless of what you do, regardless of who you are, what you become, you can't satisfy them. Without natural affection, implacable, slanderers, telling non-truth about somebody else. Without self-control, boy, we've seen a lot of that. That's even advertised and galvanized into respectability. Fierce, I mean, sometimes very mean people. No lovers of good, traitors, headstrong, puffed up, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And but notice, holding a form of godliness. How do they get by or go on? Well, some of them just keep on being religious. Maybe they think they can cover some of their tracks that way. Maybe they can lessen the depth of the imprint made by the track that way. If people see me as religious, well, it's a form of godliness. But he says, having denied the power thereof. Well, how do they deny the power of it? I guess by the way they live. There's no power in it. Look at the way they live. And yet they've got a religion. America's full of that. We've also got so many non-religious people now. But we have an awful lot of religious people that have no power. And sadly, because of the way that we have done in the church for 100 years, we've lost a lot of our power, a lot of our strength, because of the way we did the scriptures regarding the Spirit. Having denied the power thereof. And he says, Timothy, now you're living during these last days. You're living during these times. And he says, from these people now, don't hang around them. Don't stay around these people. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? If Paul particularly had in mind in the first century some people that he knew already that were members of the church. You need to avoid these people. Don't be around them. And so when I think about our times and what we've had to face, even perhaps here at Sheffield, I think about this. There are times that are grievous. Sometimes it might not be engulfing the whole brotherhood at a moment. Maybe it's one congregation. Maybe it's several congregations in an area. Or maybe it's the whole brotherhood. But it may be a time of great grievousness as well. We'll stop right there and work on this some more this afternoon. If you're here this morning and not a Christian, if you have faith in Christ as the Son of God and you know you're in sin and you need to get out, if you'll declare your faith by making your confession, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that's based on a penitent heart. You can be baptized into Christ this day. If you've done that and gone astray, we encourage you to come right now while together we stand, while we sing, won't you come?